You're listening to the MoneyWeb Now podcast series with Simon Brown. Live streamed every weekday at 6:30 a.m.
It's Wednesday, 10th of June. I'm Simon Brown, coming to you live and loud from Johannesburg, South Africa. On the show today, we've got Alex Dace. We're going to talk markets, that EOH update, as well as Soho Sun and their debt burden. Jean-Pierre Fester on finding non-fundamental red flags and how safe are our bank deposits. Some morning headlines. MoneyWeb, British American Tobacco cuts profit and revenue forecasts as COVID-19 hits demand. CNBC, China factory gate prices fall in May due to weak global demand. And morning markets overnight, the US was mixed. We had the S&P 500 off 0.8% and the tech-heavy NASDAQ making a new all-time closing high up 0.3%. In Asia, we've got Sydney up 0.3%, Tokyo up 0.2%. Commodities, gold and PGMs are green, while Brent and West Texas both over 1% down after their recent run. The ZAR is 1660 against the US dollar, and the top 40 opening call for about a third of a percent higher.
MoneyWeb Now, on the money. Also available on podcast.
Chatting with Alex Dace, you find Herbert and Thombo Wealth. Alex, morning, appreciate your time. EOH, a once market darling that sort of crashed and fell back to earth, hugely so. That stock went to a couple of rand. But a good update yesterday, really focusing on getting their debt down at an accelerated pace, faster than they'd promised the market. They're also in tech orientated, and we've seen a lot of tech stocks coming out with decent results. In short, a good update from EOH, and the market absolutely loved it, pushing the stock up some 40% at one point.
Yes, good morning, Simon. On EOH, yeah, certainly I think the rate of progress it's made so far certainly surprised the market. And as a result, you saw the share price moving up 40%. But you have to take into consideration that debt is still about four times the market cap at EOH. Mm-hmm. So any sort of good news, the stock will be heavily geared up or downwards. And there's still a lot of headwinds, I think, for EOH to overcome before you can get excited. I mean, to put in perspective, the stock is still down about 90% over the last 2 years. But certainly it was a step in the right direction, and I certainly hope they can capital proof.
Yeah, that's a good point. Let's be clear, it's moving in the right direction. This was a share at 180 Rand back in December of 2016. Let's call that 3.5 years ago. And yesterday, even after that rally, it's at 4.55. It is a long way back for EOH. Another, you mentioned the debt there, another massive debt pile. Soho Sun results came out after our close yesterday. It's too much, so bit of a, you know, it's not telling us that much. They saw foot traffic drop off markedly from mid-March. Of course, they are now essentially shut down with no indication of when they may reopen again. But here we've got a situation of a company sitting on a debt pile of 11.2 billion. That's more than double their market cap. I mean, and in an environment where at this point their current revenue is zero, and you know, no one ever planned for zero revenue for any protected period.
Yeah, certainly. So, and the stock has also rallied about 100% over the last month or so. So, yeah. You know, as you mentioned, heavily geared, no revenue. So, certainly the prospects not looking great for Soho. But I think you have to take a step back. I mean, the quality of assets are still quite good. If they can sell some of those non-core assets, you know, so and get sort of further waivers from debt lenders and so forth, perhaps they could just have enough time to pull through. But also certainly against them at this particular stage. But yeah, if you look at the market cap of that and compare that to the asset base, you can see optionality. But the problem is this debt that's hanging over there. Very, very tough time for Soho.
Yeah, and you mentioned, I mean, Soho Sun had, I mean, it was last week. It was, at one point, it was up. Well, it went from, what, a little over 2 Rand to a little over 7 Rand in a week. My sense, looking at the volumes that were going through in EOH and Soho Sun and other sort of small caps, and in some cases almost micro caps in terms of their market capitalization, this is really more a case of private clients trading their own accounts rather than asset managers such as yourself building positions.
Yeah, I think it's a combination of factors. So So obviously there's $21 trillion of liquidity that's been pumped into the market globally.
Yeah.
I think some of that money has perhaps found South Africa to some extent, but there could also be some bottom feeder investors, which could be institutional, but to say probably retail investors are looking at some of the small caps, which are, to be fair, very, very attractively valued if you do assume some sort of recovery. So there is certainly, I think, some options, and the market did perhaps reach some level that was, you know, just too low.
We've got the U.S. Federal Open Market Committee, that's our equivalent of our MPC rate announcement. Would we expect another rate cut in the U.S.? I mean, they're at 0 to 0.25%. We've seen the market recover. We saw Friday's job numbers. The data coming out on the surface is looking good. Certainly, we're also seeing some COVID-19 case rates in about 14 states in the U.S. continuing to increase. Your take on what we could expect from the Federal Reserve, probably keeping rates flat, is that a fair call?
Yeah, I think that'll be the case. At least wait, you know, until next month or so to see how the impact of the coronavirus will have on the economy and to see if there's more momentum in the recovery of data we've seen so far, specifically employment. And so that at least the Fed will have some lever to pull if need be at a later stage. But I think at this stage, there's no requirement to do so, and I'll be very surprised if they do decide to cut.
Yeah, that's a good point. The Federal Reserve meets monthly. Our equivalent meets every 2 months. It gives them a little more time. They can perhaps take a bit of a breath there and say, you know, let's come back next month. Let's see how things are. As I said, the data's ticking in the right direction, even if cases in some places are starting to rise. That's Alex Dace, so appreciate your time. You find him at Mthombo Wealth.
MoneyWeb now on the money. Also available on podcast.
Chatting with Jean-Pierre Fester, he's the CEO at Protea Capital Management. A tweet he sent out earlier in the week caught my attention. I'm not going to mention names because I don't want to give lawyers any extra work. The tweet said, their sponsors are on my checklist for attributes associates of good shorts. Jean-Pierre, appreciate your time. My reading of that tweet is that you run a hedge fund, so you're going long and short of stocks, but your shorts are not necessarily perhaps always purely fundamental plays. They're red flags that you're looking for at the same time.
Quite right, Simon. Yes, the fundamentals are important, going through the financial statements and looking for some red flags in the numbers, but they are also always qualitative factors that are also useful to find these red flags and shorting opportunities and suspicions that there might be something deeper when you see one of these qualitative characteristics of a company.
Hey, and what would those be? I mean, from your tweet, obviously, sometimes it's going to be the advisors. It might be an auditor that no one's ever heard of from a town that no one can find on a map. Is it those sort of things that you're looking for and more, I imagine?
Quite right, yes. So I would put them in two categories. I would say either other sources of information, which is more qualitative, and then the second category I would call associations. So who is associated with the company? So other sources, for instance, is in the financial statements, other than numbers, you have other pieces of information. For instance, there's always the key audit matters. That's part of the audit report, which I always find interesting. Or for instance, if you go into the notes nearer to the end of the financial statements in the report, the tax notes are very interesting to see if there are any big tax or other litigation matters, actually. Another source would be, for instance, to think about the perspective of the client or the supplier to this company. For instance, if they sell something and you haven't bought it yourself, maybe go out and buy it yourself, or at least speak to someone who has bought it and see what they believe of the product or service of the company. So those are the other sources, I would say.
Yeah, so some good old-fashioned legwork, and I agree with you. When I'm looking at results, I often go for one of the first thing is I have a look at the results. Well, what about some other things? And maybe they're almost too abstract in a sense. One that always bothered me was, you know, the CEOs with giant egos. And we've had a few over the years. What I note is that mostly all of them have exited the JSE and usually, you know, not in a blaze of glory, usually with their heads hung low.
Yes, that's a tricky one, Simon, if you think about the personality of a CEO, because it has been said before that it's not necessarily the wallflowers who become the CEO. So
good point.
The man or woman that becomes the CEO of a company probably has a type A personality, probably needed to beat some very strong competition to get to the top of the corporate ladder. So that's very difficult to just go on the personality. And that's why I mentioned other sources, but the other one is associates. So yeah. I'd rather look at that rather than the characteristics of the person. And associates could be what sponsor does the company use. Also the directors, you speak about the CEO. So what other associates does the director have? Are there companies of the CEO that does business with the same company?
Mm-hmm.
That is a big red flag. Are there non-executives on the board that have got other business interests or other associations, for instance, also being involved with other companies that you know for a fact something is going on that's wrong? And then you mentioned right at the beginning, for instance, an association with an auditor that no one has heard of, which is very rare also these days. But those network of associates of a CEO or even non-executive directors are quite important, I believe.
You mentioned board directors. The one which I've been digging around for a bit is independent board members. King says that should be 10 years. There are boards out there where the independent directors have got sort of more than two decades experience on the board. And I appreciate experience, and I think experience is valuable. There also comes a point where you lose your independence and you almost, in a sense, are captured.
Yes, it can happen. I would remind you, I'm also a director.
No, I know.
I'm an independent director at Capitec. But it's a very important point. And I would say it's once again a balance. On the one hand, that experience, people who have been on a board for longer than 10 years, is invaluable. To have some gray hair around the table. And Berkshire Hathaway, for instance, if you think about someone like Warren Buffett, he loves some of the directors that have been on the Berkshire's board for decades because they come with all that experience. But at the same time, I agree with you. You also need investors or rather directors that come in with fresh eyes, that are truly independent, that have no business dealings with the company and can give a critical independent view. And I would say it's a balance between the two. If you only have a bunch of young or academic or otherwise independent directors with no experience, that's, I would say, just as bad. So a good balance between directors who might not be seen as being independent just from the fact that they've been serving for more than 10 years, some of that would be good and some independence would be good, so that any board functions at its best when it has diversity of opinion, whether in gender, in race, in independence, or in experience. And that's probably the best thing you would want, a board that is balanced.
A board balanced, diverse. And I think balance is perhaps the key phrase here to end off. I mean, you see something which raises a red flag, you don't rush out and short it. It's building a preponderance of evidence. It's perhaps keeping a watch list. It's finding that balance of probability, some red flag, some fundamental data coming through, maybe a product which you know, you've tried and thought was, you know, fundamentally inferior.
Correct. So we like to combine the fundamental data, the hard numbers that we see that the company reports, plus the qualitative data, the softer issues that you can't put in a spreadsheet in Excel. And if you combine the qualitative and these fundamental data sets, you get a quantamental view. That's the term we use to combine the best of both worlds and get a fair and balanced assessment of a company, taking into account what the hard numbers tell us, but also then stepping away and not looking at the company through a spreadsheet and think about these softer issues, the people involved, and these other qualitative factors.
I like that. Quantamental. That's a phrase I will use. I will credit it with you. That was Jean-Pierre Fister. He's the CEO at Protea Capital Management. Really appreciate your time.
Business, finance, and investment news. MoneyWeb Now.
With Simon Brown.
On the Money. Also available on podcast.
Chatting now with Leletu Poso. He's a fixed income analyst at Anchor. Leletu, appreciate your time this morning. We want to talk bank deposits and how safe they are. Before we get to that, I mean, the broader picture is in South Africa had some major regulatory reforms to enhance resilience of our financial sector. The Twin Peaks legislation, the FSCA forming out of the FSB. As a country, we have a very strong regulatory environment, an environment which, frankly, as a country, we can be proud and happy with.
Yes, morning, Simon. Thanks for having me around. Yes, as you said, the regulation framework in South Africa for the banking sector is very, very good. It's for the past 10 years, the regulation that has been deployed have been used to enhance the banking system. The likes of capital and liquidity buffers have been improving. So when COVID-19 hit our shores early on this year, it found itself looking at a financial system with substantial capital and liquidity buffers. Those exact same buffers that are used to absorb shocks when they hit the economic system.
Yeah, I want to come to those buffers in a second. At the heart of banking is ultimately banks take deposits and then they allocate this cash to long-term sort of productive investors, productive into the economy. And this is exactly how banking works. Take on the one side, lend out on the other. It means ultimately depositors are funding those loans. And you mentioned, obviously, when a pandemic hits, it's going to add some pressure in that environment. We're going to see impairments, bad debts, as we used to call them, rising, and it is going to put some squeeze on the banks.
Yes, 100%. Those exact same buffers are used to absorb these losses. And with them being very substantial at the moment, it also helps depositors who sit pretty much upstairs as to the subordination level that's still there for the gap between the entry level first loss hits and where they are is very, very big. So it kind of leaves the deposits with a lot of room for runway for the deposits to be safe, given those regulatory measures that have been deployed by regulators in South Africa.
Yeah, and we've got, and you mentioned it, we've got, and it's, you talk around that buffer, we've got the Basel III, which kind of came out of the last financial crisis back in 2008, 2009. At that point, we had Basel II, and that is telling banks how much capital they need to hold. We call them capital adequacy ratios, and there's different levels of them. The research report that you put out yesterday shows very much so that across the board, certainly our big banks are well ahead of those requirements. They've actually got more than they need, and that strengthens their position for when a crisis such as the pandemic arrives. They're actually in a good position to weather that storm.
Yes, 100%. That is true. Adoption of Basel III reforms has risen the capital adequacy ratios for banks since 2008-2009, and those actually the key focus of Basel III was strengthening the capital base of the banking sector. Currently, right now, the big banks, as you said, now to even go further, I was talking about the big six banks, are well capitalized at the moment, showing the resilience to the economic shock that we're currently experiencing. So those buffers are actually helping to absorb these losses, and it's really comforting to see that this proactive approach by the regulators for the past 10 years is actually helping the system now to be able to maneuver during this shock.
Yeah, and you make a great point there. And it is, you know, it stands us in good stead as a country to have that. I suppose to conclude, I mean, one of the things that struck me was how many banks we have in South Africa. You mentioned the top six. I could add a couple more names to it. But of course, actually, we have dozens and dozens. We have excess of 70 banks in South Africa. If we look at the top tiers, we look at our banking industry broadly, would it be fair to say at the end of the day, the banks are well capitalized, even for a pandemic such as COVID-19. And the crux of the question is that largely our deposits at the large banks are going to be safe. The banks are very likely, we'll put it the other way, we are unlikely to see any of those banks come under significant strain, even during a global pandemic.
So, yes, there are a lot of banks in South Africa. I'm looking at around about 74 as of end of March. However, I'd like to caution the usage of the word, or the explicit usage of the word of safety,
mm-hmm.
As banks are not immune to this shock. They've come under significant strain pre-COVID and during COVID. So the usage of the word safety needs to be pegged with some sort of explicit guarantee coming from the regulators. Mm-hmm. And at the moment, there's absolutely no explicit arrangements in place to protect depositors or the utilization of taxpayers' money by National Treasury to reimburse depositors should a bank fail. At the moment, we are pretty much pinging on the implicit support, given the fact that, as you said, the big banks, they will cause a systemic risk if a big bank could fail. So we need to pretty much hinge on that implicit support, as previously, government has compensated and actually supported the banking system during times of stress, and they've also supported depositors during a bank failure with a couple of cases in 2014 and 2018. However, we find ourselves that the fiscal setting for the government's finances are not pretty much strong, leading towards COVID. And with COVID coming into play, we see that the banks have come under significant strain, and also those state finances have come under material strain. So banks are not immune to the shock. Our deposits are not entirely safe, as we are counting on this implicit support. This implicit support stemming from the state.
Yeah, that's a great point. It's implicit support. We do not have depositor insurance in South Africa. It is implicit. The banks, the Reserve Bank has stepped up before. No guarantee they will do so again. Naledi Poswa, fixed income analyst at ANCAC. Appreciate your time this morning. That's it for today. You'll find us live every weekday morning, 6:30 a.m. at moneyweb.co.za or the MoneyWeb app. The podcast available from 7 a.m. Chat to us on the social medias using hashtag MoneyWeb. My thanks to you for listening, my guests, my producer, my sound engineer. My name is Simon Brown. This is MoneyWeb Now. We'll chat again tomorrow.
You've been listening to another MoneyWeb Now podcast, posted every weekday at 7 a.m. on moneyweb.co.za. MoneyWeb Now, on the money.